Good morning. May it please the court. Ketanji Jackson representing the appellant Andre Brown. I would like to reserve 2 minutes for rebuttal. When the government alleges that a previously convicted felon illegally possessed a loaded firearm, there is no separate possession of ammunition offense for the purpose of Section 922G. In this case, the government accused Mr. Brown of possessing a semi-automatic pistol, which was allegedly loaded with 8 rounds of ammunition. The jury heard the police testimony about the loaded gun, and they also heard the court's initial firearm instruction, which charged them with determining whether or not Mr. Brown possessed a firearm. This case was obviously and at all times about whether or not Mr. Brown had a gun in his glove compartment, as the government alleged. Yet the district court ultimately instructed the jurors that they could find Mr. Brown guilty of possessing either the firearm.
Was he charged with firearm and ammunition?
He was charged with firearm and ammunition based on the
How can you say that there's not an offense for possessing the ammunition?
Because according to the government's own statement, the basis for the firearm and ammunition charge was the fact that the allegation that Mr. Brown possessed a loaded weapon. There is no separate possession of ammunition count.
Did not say that,
no, Your Honor, but
you'd like it to, but it doesn't.
But the charges that are in the indictment are based on evidence that was presented to the grand jury. Mm-hmm. It's not as though you look only at the wording of the indictment without any consideration of what the government's actual evidence was. When the government said firearm and ammunition in the context of the indictment,
evidence of firearm and ammunition.
They offered evidence which, according to their own statement, was the defendant is charged with unlawful possession of a firearm and ammunition, which we allege occurred by the fact that the defendant had inside the glove box of his vehicle the .45 caliber pistol that was loaded with the ammunition. Their allegation was that the defendant possessed a gun that had ammunition inside of it. There was no allegation.
The allegation was that he possessed a firearm and that he possessed ammunition.
The allegation was that he possessed a firearm that was loaded with
that
8 rounds.
That. I've got the indictment in front of me, and that's not the allegation.
Yes,
the allegation,
sir, but
is he possessed a pistol, .45 caliber semi-automatic pistol, and he possessed ammunition, .45 caliber ammunition, right?
The allegation, that is the statement in the indictment, and the government always alleges the indictment in the conjunction in that fashion.
We have case law that says if you charge it in the disjunctive, you haven't charged him with anything because he can't read it and tell what he's charged with. That's case law, ancient case law to that effect, that they have to charge in the conjunctive.
Yes, for notice purposes.
But they only have to prove in the disjunctive.
But that is in a circumstance. Our argument is that they only have to prove in the disjunctive in a circumstance in which there are alternative violations.
All right, now suppose here, the evidence here on the nature of that gun, nature of that firearm, was pretty confused, wasn't it? As to whether it was a .45 or a 9mm or what that.
The government alleged that it was a .45. Yeah. There was evidence.
The evidence. Now you're talking about the evidence. You're the one who wanted to get into the evidence.
Yes, sir.
Don't try to run me out of it now. The evidence was pretty confused as to what kind of firearm it was, right?
The evidence, there was a discrepancy in the evidence presented.
Right. At 9mm, it said .45, and it had that. I'm not sure if it's a trial or at the hearing, but there was that ridiculous testimony by the officer about using.
It was at the hearing. Mm-hmm. It was at the hearing, and the defense counsel was attempting to, as defense counsels do, cast doubt on the police officer's testimony,
right,
whether there was,
right,
you know,
even
a weapon at all.
Trial, it came up that there was a discrepancy in the description of the firearm.
Yes, as a matter.
The jury could may have been unconvinced or divided as to whether he possessed a .45 automatic or some other sort of firearm, right?
But that's pure speculation.
Right.
This jury.
Always speculation when you're looking back at what a jury could have done.
Except in this case.
You're telling me the jury could not have found guilt of the ammunition without finding guilt of the firearm.
Not as a matter of fact based on the evidence that the government presented.
What I'm trying to get you to discuss with me is what the evidence was. And the evidence on the .45 firearm was not as clear as the evidence on the .45 ammunition.
Correct, but the jury had to reach a determination as to whether or not under the circumstances, Mr. Brown possessed a firearm if...
And they reached the decision, they were convinced beyond a reasonable doubt that he possessed ammunition.
Without...
But they were not convinced unanimously beyond a reasonable doubt that he possessed a firearm.
But we are arguing that factually, under these circumstances, they could not have, the district court should not have led them to make such a conclusion.
And I'm suggesting the way in which they could have, and you're telling me that's pure speculation.
I'm saying that under the facts of this case, which was a loaded firearm case, we're not talking about a situation in which the defendant was accused of possessing a firearm in one place and ammunition in another.
Possessing in the first place, there are cases, and you know that, that say that the jury verdict does not have to be consistent.
Absolutely, and we are not challenging the jury verdict by itself. What we're challenging is when the jury asked, Your Honor, if we find that the defendant possessed one or the other, must we find that he possessed both? And in this particular case, given the evidence that the jury had been presented, they could not have found that he possessed the ammunition without also...
Why could they not have been unconvinced on the nature of the firearm?
The nature of the firearm was not an essential element. The first
two...
However...
He's charged with possessing a 45 caliber semi-automatic.
He is.
Now, if your client had been put to trial on that 45, that indictment charging a 45 caliber semi-automatic, and the court had, the prosecution had come in with evidence that proved beyond a reason that he was carrying a 22 rifle.
Well, the government has
they couldn't have convicted on that, could they?
Yes, they could have. In many cases, it has been established.
You're standing on your hind legs barking about how they could
have. We may have, because we would have been arguing a sort of a chain of custody. There was no evidence. But according to the law, the element, the caliber of the firearm is not an element of the offense.
According to the law,
the government has argued in many cases.
You can't be convicted of a crime you're not charged. You have to be
convicted. Excuse me, the cases you rely on from the 11th Circuit, that's a significant part of them, that the indictment is, by being specific, is narrower than, in fact, what was charged to the jury. And I really understood that to be your central claim. You aren't making a claim, are you, that jury verdicts have to be logical?
Absolutely not, Your Honor.
That's what I understood.
Absolutely not. Our claim is that the court had to instruct the jury as to both the facts and the law in the case. And
so
under these circumstances...
So is it your theory that whenever a defendant is charged with possessing a loaded gun, the instruction must be in the conjunctive?
It is my claim that the government always has the option of choosing whether or not to put forward a claim that the person possessed a firearm, that the person possessed ammunition.
If the defendant possesses a loaded weapon, is the government free to charge him for possessing a gun and ammunition?
If the government wishes to put to the jury or make the allegation that the defendant is possessing a loaded weapon, which I note they do perhaps in order to establish that this person is an imminent threat or something like that, then they have to prove both the gun and the ammunition. The government, if the government didn't want to do that, they could charge the person with possessing only the firearm, or they could charge the person with possessing only the ammunition, which it has done.
I don't understand what you're saying at all.
Yeah, so are you saying they're not free to charge him in the conjunctive? In other words, with a loaded weapon, their only option is to charge them with possessing just a gun?
No, they may charge him with possessing the firearm and the ammunition, but the government, under those circumstances, should not be allowed to split the baby factually. If they're saying...
It isn't the government that's splitting the baby factually. It's the jury that's splitting the baby factually. The government's happy to have a conviction on both.
But the government has to have the... It can't have the conviction on ammunition alone if the evidence is that he had a loaded weapon. I mean,
I haven't gone back to it, but it seems to me that we're constantly upholding jury verdicts, which, when you look at the evidence, make no sense. The same witness with exactly the same credibility has said that two different things of drugs were delivered in the same bag, and the jury says yes to one and no to the other.
And where the defendant's claim is that you need to reverse this conviction because the jury's verdict is inconsistent, this court has said, no, we're not going to do that because juries are free to render inconsistent verdicts.
Right.
Our claim is that the district court in this case instructed the jury in a manner that led it to lead to.
That's what happens in a case where there are two different types of drugs in the same bag.
Well, if
right?
the, but the judge.
One for marijuana and one for cocaine and different result, and all the testimony links the two drugs. Just
well, in that possible. Case, the drugs are actually not factually part of the same unit as ammunition inside of a gun. The jury in this case asked, how can we find that he possessed a gun without finding that can we find that he possessed the ammunition without finding that he possessed the gun? And as a factual matter, it could not.
I don't see why it couldn't.
Yeah,
you keep turning me aside when I say the evidence, the charge was a 45 caliber, the instruction is a 45 caliber. The evidence is a little bit confused. I don't see why it's even difficult to think that a jury could have been unconvinced that the government had proved beyond a reasonable doubt, unanimously, not unanimously, but on the possession of a 45 caliber firearm, but still everybody that testified said this ammunition was 45 caliber ammunition. I don't.
Because our claim is that the caliber of the firearm is not an essential element.
That's
so whether the jury
true.
Was
That's
confused.
True and not real relevant to what a jury might do. Given that a jury is here, has with them, in this case, I think, they had the indictment with them that said 45 caliber automatic.
Right, and they also had the instructions which said either or and in a circumstance in which
yeah.
they could not find as a factual matter. I see that my time has expired.
Your time is, we'll give you back a couple of minutes for rebuttal.
Good morning.
Morning, Counsel.
May it please the court, Daria Zane on behalf of the appellee, and with me at council table is Stephen Wasserman and Roy McLeese. The trial court did not err in instructing the jury that they could find the appellant guilty of count one if they found that he either possessed ammunition or a firearm. The instruction mirrored the language of 922 G1. In addition, it was consistent with well-settled principle that where the indictment is read in the conjunctive and the statute is in the disjunctive, that it's appropriate to instruct in the disjunctive. Appellant argues about this being an inconsistent verdict, but
go back to the instruction. Because the appellant's arguing the instruction's wrong. That's what the appellant's challenging the instruction, right?
Yes, the appellant's challenging
the
instruction.
So if the jury had reasonable doubt that the defendant possessed a loaded weapon, how could it not have reasonable doubt that he possessed ammunition?
Because the way the facts were presented in this case, the instruction was either or, and the facts that they were presented, the challenge was
just
that there was...
with my question. If you're charged with possessing a loaded weapon, the jury has reasonable doubt whether you possess the gun. How could it believe beyond a reasonable doubt that he possessed ammunition if it was a loaded weapon?
Well, in this particular case, the jury could find that because the defense theory was that it was a 9mm, not a 45 caliber. Now, as we know, that's not an essential element, but that was their theory, and that's how they presented it. So what the jury did is they did the easy homework. They went and said, okay, this is a 45 caliber ammunition. There's been no dispute about that. We believe it's 45 caliber ammunition, but we may not.
Your theory is the jury didn't have any doubt that he possessed a gun. They just doubted what kind of gun it was?
Yes, that's our theory.
Well, since that's not an element of the crime, why wouldn't they have convicted on that? What difference would it have made?
Well, under the circumstances here.
Said, right?
I'm sorry. Under the circumstances here, they only needed to reach a verdict as to one. The verdict form that was presented to them, they had a choice of either finding firearm or ammo. They found ammo, and then their job was done as far as they were concerned. And it's similar.
I'm questioning whether the assumption is correct that if they were unconvinced on the nature of the gun, they could still find him guilty because it's a gun. I mean, there are various cases up there that say the government's evidence has to match its obligations, and if the government
that's certainly true under the.
It
seems to be clearly true under the 11th Circuit cases that the appellant relies on, because those cases, Narok and Weissman, are clearly concerned about events at trial broadening the charge in the indictment. And if you go from a 45 millimeter gun to any gun, you've effectively broadened the charge in the indictment. So I'm quite sure that we would have a strong claim of error if it had gone to the jury, just you have to find a gun.
Well, in this particular case, we did present evidence that it was a 45 caliber. The evidence presented.
It's not only that you presented evidence, but I seriously question whether the government could switch in the middle of trial from a charge of a specific type of gun to any old gun. Certainly, as I say, certainly those 11th Circuit cases that the appellant relies on would not permit that. That's exactly what happened in one of them, a switch from a named mafia family to any old mafia family. And the 9th Circuit reversed. I'm sorry, 11th Circuit reversed.
And I was not suggesting that that's what the government was doing at all in this particular case.
I don't think you're understanding the direction of our question. You seem to be willing to concede that the nature of the gun not being an essential element, therefore a jury could return a verdict of guilty even if they were unconvinced on the nature of the gun. Judge Williams and I are not accepting that concession. We're suggesting that the government has to prove the case it charges, and in fact, if I were defending and you filed an indictment that just said he possessed a firearm, I would have been up on my hind legs barking for a bill of particulars saying, what kind of firearm do you say he possessed? It may not be a theoretical element of a crime, but if you're preparing to defend against charges, you're entitled to the specific charges, and you're entitled to a trial in which the government can't expand its proof. So these are not hostile questions when we're asking you what we're asking you.
Yeah, and I think I did misunderstand. We do agree that, in fact, the government has the burden, as the 11th Circuit cases suggest, that when we put a charge and we put a 45 caliber gun in this case, that we present proof of that 45 caliber gun, and we did in this particular case. The difference between the 11th Circuit and what's at issue here is there it was an essential. The issue was the nature of the firearm, and that was the nature of what they had charged in the indictment. Whereas here, the instruction that was given was consistent with the statute, and it didn't change the nature of the charges here.
Well, actually, the interesting thing is that because of this rule that the indictment must be phrased in the conjunctive, in effect, when the charge is phrased in the disjunctive, that does widen the charge from what it was in the indictment. But that appears to be a widening that is not only permissible but required in the law, whereas the sort of widening that was involved in the 11th Circuit cases was an impermissible kind. It was not within that conjunctive, disjunctive special rule.
Yes, and we agree. The bottom line here is what appellant is asking the court to do is to set out and carve an exception that there is no basis for. This would be a situation, it would result in the judge interfering with the jury's fact-finding duty as well as be unwieldy. It would be a situation such as if you had a charge of robbery of a senior citizen and the complainant got on the stand and testified, I'm 75 years old and I was robbed. And the judge would be instructing, for instance, in a number of cases that there's a lesser included offense. But under the appellant's theory, he would be barred from doing that because he would say, once you find that there's a robbery of Mr. Jones who's 75, you must find that there's a robbery of a senior citizen. And that's just inconsistent with the way that jury instructions have worked. And in addition, it would be unwieldy because it may be simple in this case, but it would require a judge to go into the fact-finding process and analyze the facts and not only present the law, but then also analyze the facts and set the parameters for the jury as to what their fact-finding can be. For those reasons, we believe that, indeed, that the jury instruction was accurate and correct, and we would ask that the court affirm the judgment below.
Thank you, counsel. Now, the time was up, but we'll give you back 2 minutes for rebuttal.
Thank you, sir.
I would just like to draw the court's attention to the verdict form, which you can find on pages 39 and 40 of the appendix, because this points out precisely why it's really the court should not assume that the jury was confused about caliber necessarily. The court put the verdict form to the jurors, and it says unlawful possession of a firearm, no mention of caliber, or unlawful possession of ammunition. And the jury ultimately, by its note, said we can't reach a unanimous verdict as to whether or not Mr. Brown possessed a firearm. And so the question is, as a factual matter, if the jury could not reach that verdict and, in fact, did not because the district court instructed them that they didn't have to, whether or not the district court's instruction was error. And we think that the verdict form shows clearly why, in breaking these out as two separate charges, the court's instruction was erroneous. We also note that the jury's note itself never said, we're confused about the caliber, does it matter?
Well, that simply offered the suggestion as to how a jury could have reached the apparently inconsistent verdict. But you're left with the case law that supports upholding facially inconsistent verdicts.
We also have the case law that says that a district court has to instruct the jurors properly. Whether or not the jurors ultimately reach an inconsistent verdict, when the jury says, Your Honor, under these facts, if we determine that Mr. Brown possessed the ammunition, must we also determine whether or not he possessed the gun? The answer is yes, because in these circumstances, under this case, the indictment could not have been charged disjunctively factually. In a situation in which the indictment is conjunctive and the charge is disjunctive, ordinary course of events is that the indictment is charging in the conjunctive alternative methods. In this case, the indictment could not have been charged firearm or ammunition because the evidence was that there was a loaded weapon. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel, and thanks to the Office of the Public Defender and the United States Attorney for the continued service to the United States. I'll call the next one.